What's up, dude?
This meeting is being recorded.
I'm trying to get this Riverside thing to work because it seems like it's a better option, but I don't know how.
Wait, before you record it, before you hit record.
I started recording.
Got something for you.
Well, I won't. It's just records, but I won't include this.
But Scout's honor. Work with me on this instead of stealing it from me.
Oh yeah, I'm not gonna. What the fuck?
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, but semi-serious. No, dude. Like, so one of my clients who I've been working with for about 8 months now. He was like a Forbes 30 under 30 guy. Back in I think 4 years ago, he started. Him and his buddy, his college buddy, took like a $50,000 loan from the friend's dad to start an electric e-bike company.
Okay. Are those the cool? Keep going.
And last year it did $170 million in revenue.
What the fuck? That's crazy.
Yeah. So bonkers, right?
I have a hard time wrapping my head around numbers like that.
Totally. So he's a big fan of your content, and actually he and I work out on Tuesdays, and so he wants to meet you when you come out on.
That would be great. I love 18. That.
So he was I got him on the minimalist shoe train because like for some of the ankle he like found me through the ATG coaches map, and like that's how we started working together and stuff. And so I got him on the barefoot shoe life, like all that stuff. And then he was like, I think I want to get into this business. And I was like, so we started talking about like some of the logistical challenges with it. And he kind of like backed off from that. But today, Tess called me all excited. She had such a good idea. I had one of my own. There's no well-established or aesthetically pleasing barefoot shoe, like wide toe box shoe for kids.
Okay.
And if you could like get in with a, you know, preventing these problems from happening rather than having to undo decades of work or, you know, of the wrong kind of conditioning, starting kids off in a way that like, because when they're, if they're young enough, they don't care, like it'll probably be more comfortable for them.
Yeah,
you could prevent all the problems. So I was talking, so we had a call with him today. We were talking about like some of the logistical challenges with that side of the business, and you know what, it hit me, this is where the big financial opportunity is in wide toe box shoes.
Okay.
Military boots, Department of Defense contract.
Dude, so there's a guy, yes, is the answer to your question. That absolutely is the biggest money. There's a guy, Nature Athletics, he's got that, like, the shitty looking cleats, but, well, they're not bad looking, but it's just like, he was in the Marines or something like that, and so he ended up spending a lot of money trying to get his boots like that, and I think this guy's probably a little bit like on the spectrum, but he like wrote this whole paper, this whole thing, took it to a sergeant, like, we got to do this. And they're just like, no, like there is, yes, the opportunity is there, but it's like there's a political side of getting, if you can get into the right person, that it is there, but the reason it hasn't been cracked is not because of like logic. It's because of like people just don't think they're the wrong people are in power in some sense. So like, if the opportunity is there, yeah, unbelievable. But so yeah, does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And like my parents were both in the military, so they've like shared with me some horror stories about like wastefulness and resistance to change and all that. But what I thought could be related to this, and this was based on some of the stuff when I was answering your DMs, and actually I got to Google this just to be sure, but I don't think there's a wide toe box steel toe, like construction boot.
I don't think, No, I don't think so. I don't think that there is. Typically, most construction boots are wider.
Okay.
The hard part is, you'd really have to look at the options out there, just because it's like, it's steel, and it's like they tend to be a broad. So the wider the base of a boot is, the more stability you have. So it's like better on a job site. You want a heavier thing. It's like, so they're incentivized to be bigger and blockier. But what I think is interesting is the if you could ex if you could look at and like how heavy does it need to be? It could
Right.
be steel toed, or it could be like a carbon fiber. Like there are so many ways you could go back and explore the manufacture of these things that like for guys that are wearing these boots for hours and hours on end, it's just basically you're in a cast. It's like, does it have to be flexible or stiff all the way through? And like, could it be like there's a whole lot of stuff that I think if it would be worth looking at like OSHA. And figuring out like what are their actual recommendations, what are the requirements for that boot?
Yeah.
But that is the top question. You saw this too. Everyone, what are the best steel toe boots? What are the boots for working? What are it's like they're there.
So what I'm saying is, if me and Tess and Robbie launch a barefoot shoe company, do you want to be in on this?
Course, I'd be happy to support, and then that's bread and butter. So that'd be great. Yeah, we could talk more when you're down there. It's the shoe market's tough, but if you have a way to get in there, then I know how to make good ads. And
And because we were, what he brought up is for like kids, you need a whole bunch of SKUs, like half sizes. And he's like, if you take Ben Patrick's, for example, they have two colors and they don't do half sizes. It's like, it requires a lot of.
kids, this is what I would go with kids. I wouldn't do a shoe. I would do like a durable sock.
A sock?
So it's not a sock, but think about it like a sock, something that you stretch. You put it like you would. You get rid of the half size problem by having a shoe that flexes, because like
Interesting. But is that going to be like safe on concrete and blacktop? Like,
You have there's a texture on the bottom that is stretched. I mean, you'd have to look at what the materials are, but it's like safe is a relative term in some capacity. But if it's not like this is the only shoe, but like if you could have a shoe that's foldable, washable, and
yeah.
flexible, like the, in a sense that is like that's where you get the sock. But it's like how do you put the shoe on? You just put it on like a sock in a sense. And so if you have a sock and something like that. That to me seems like if I were a parent, oh my God, that would be amazing. It's like for,
Yeah.
of course the kid's gonna run down the blacktop, but like the problem is we think about it like we think about our use case for adults. Well, I'm gonna go for a walk. Why? Because I don't have any physics. I don't play. I don't do anything. You want it to be safe enough that you go on the playground, you could go to the park, you could
For
run around.
sure.
Generally, but it's like you want it to be one or two colors, brown and black, something like that, whereas you just throw it on, and it's pretty minimal. You could throw it in the washer and like something along, like if you get the fabric for that it's like your kid's gonna grow. And the last thing you do is buy a shoe that fits him now.
Well, so that was Tess's idea to be like the real differentiator is you almost do it like a subscription service and say, so you sign up for 2 years, like say you paid 150 bucks, and for those 2 years, you can get three pairs of shoes or 2 years, whichever happens first, and then you renew at the end of that time period. So you differentiate by solving that problem of like, why am I going to buy this specialized shoe if my kid's going to grow out of it in 6 months? It's like, well, send it in and then you get this next one.
And then we turn around and give that shoe to a low income some.
100%. That's exactly what we said. We donate it into like inner cities in Appalachia.
Yeah, I like how those two diet demographics are incredibly extreme, but both the lowest of the yeah. No, I think it's look. I mean, there's there's endless potential there, and nobody's really gotten into it. I think that it's there's a lot of value there. So playing around with some of these things, like, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. Yeah, and absolutely, I think there's. I mean, I've got connections with Anya and the shoe. Like, there's enough of the people that I know that are in the shoe thing. So like, in terms of, I mean, because there's another aspect too. Is like, I don't know how much. you look at like Paluva with Mark Sisson, like they're a foot friendly thing, but they don't have anything for kids. And right. Look, I'm not saying it has to be that, but like, dude, there is so much, just even when I would talk to Jeff with Nature Athletics, the amount of money it takes to get a last made that's custom and then go and do that and send it out. He's trying to get into that. He's the closest I know of that's trying to get like an athletic based shoe thing for kids. Mm-hmm. But there's something, his energy, it just doesn't connect. You know what I mean? Like yeah. This, I don't know how else to say that other than that, like, just. Like,
yeah, you don't have to say anymore. I get it. Yeah.
But there is sometimes, you know, Mark's a brilliant business guy. And so some of these, like, getting in and, like, being within an established, I'm just saying in terms of like, if we have other things we're trying to do, getting into being with an established brand that's already kind of making marks and like, you know, my David has already got the adult toe spread thing. It doesn't have to be like that, but I'm saying like, in terms of, you know, having some of those conversations there, that is something to consider. I just say, hey, let's run and we're going to do the foot thing, but like, let's combine and make this. Cause when it comes to shoes, unfortunately brand matters. The reason people like oh. Because everyone knows Vivo, you know, and like, so in some sense, if you could take some that's already got momentum and make it like a bigger thing, then it's like they're not there. Just I'm good, really good friends with Mark. He emailed me this morning, so
yeah.
I'm not saying we have to do that at all. I'm just saying that there might be a quicker to market, quicker return by like working with someone who's Mark's 3 or 4 years into
the. Is Mark the founder of Vivo or.
No. Mark is the founder of Paluva, but he's the
got it.
Sisson, Primal Foods.
I mean, I don't know if I'm answering that. Paluva.
He looks like he's 40, but he's 60. Mark's M-I-S-I-S-S-O-N.
Paluva.
Paluva is the one, they're the toe separated shoe. They're basically Vibram Five Fingers, but if they were made with a little bit more.
Mark is the founder.
Yeah, Mark, yeah. But this is like he's done multiple business ventures before this.
Right? Got it.
So my point though is I like him. I spent a lot of time on the phone with him, just in various things. He's a very kind guy. But again, I'm not saying this is something to do, but like if you can find a brand that's big enough that it's got some connection, like people kind of like, you know, with David, they've got, there he's getting tons of sales. I love them. I have a pair that is actually my favorite running shoe for like mid to hard long distance. But there's my point is they're not gonna look at kids' shoes because he's 60. He has no interest. It's not, but we could come in and like have a subsect of that. But basically, instead of having to think, hey, we got this brand new shoe company, we got this brand new thing. It's like let's just come. Right. I've already got market share. Mark's already got a ton of like he's got money. Totally. Distributors, he's got it makes those things like you have a company within a company in a sense totally. That six, seven things over just thoughts, but
I love it. Like this is it's exciting stuff. Yeah.
I'll be having kid, you know, we'll be looking at see now the sad part is if you and Destin we're kind of kids you brand, we don't have any kids, but you'll adopt a few. I have to do my replacement to make up for the fact that you're not gonna have any kids. So I'm gonna start my four kids next year, the beginning of that. So
can I read you something really funny?
You may, please.
Okay, let me find it. Have we talked about we'll talk about Gabor Mate.
Yeah, I like him.
But anyway, so in the video course of his, because his stuff is all about like, we'll dive deeper into it. It's all about like figuring out your unpacking your childhood emotional trauma so it no longer controls you, basically. Yeah. So he shared this poem that was really funny. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They do not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-fashioned hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at each other's throats. Man, hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
just start with that and just roll in and just see where the conversation goes. That's fantastic. I'm sure you actually heard that. We're like, thank you. This is it's in poetry.
I was like, yeah, that was written for me. No.
Well, you know what? I I hold the opposite view, which is you do all this work to grow out of those things, so you like, you know, you might as well pass on your positive intentions. But yeah. You know, it's interesting. The kids thing is interesting. I want to look at next year. I'm planning on knocking up Tiana, so it's the
that's the plan, huh?
Yeah.
I know.
But
she excited about that too.
She's ready. She's definitely ready. She's excited. She's gonna be a great mom. I mean, the cool thing about her is that she's been working with kids from like ages 18 and up for 10 years now. Like, sorry, 18. I mean, 18 months to like, you know, 18 years old. And so, but she is so interested, and she like so good. Like every week, she puts together these preschool circuits to get kids, like get them upside down, get them to hang, get them to move, and so all these really cool things where, you know, there's like you just think about the physical development of a kid. And so she's very much into that. It's really cool to think about the opportunity just to work with a kid and like, you know, from the very beginning, it's like have them continually like, you know, have some awareness about the shoes. I mean, all the things that you have an awareness of with the body in some capacity, just to be able to like, okay. All right. So let's just roll into it because there's so many things we're going to start in that, but I do like, let's talk more about there's a lot there. I really like that idea. And I think that if that's something that you're interested in and he's interested at all, then there's a lot to explore there.
Absolutely.
All right. So Greg, I just am so happy to always see you. First off, you look good. And so last time we talked, I know there's not a video component of this, but I know you've done so many internal explorations, but last time we talked, there was like a darkness about you, like a somberness about you that I could just take a weight on your eyes. And then you, it was really cool because one of the blogs, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks, I don't even know what time it is anymore, but you said you did it was retreat, and then a bunch of tears came out. And it's like, after reading that, I was like, that makes a lot of sense. I just felt like there was a seriousness and a weight that was behind your eyes. And I think it was like you were in between retreats. So let's just start there. Like, I want to hear about that experience because we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But
yeah, I think our last, I can't remember if our last one was before my retreat. The first retreat was March 14th, I think, was the date that it started. Let me double check on that. So I think our last conversation was before that.
Yeah, I think. Well, it was after you had done the ayahuasca. No, is that a different one?
Ayahuasca. Yeah.
It was after that, before the other retreat, because there was this in between where you, I think, you were like processing and had a lot of stuff that you had kind of thought through, or at least was coming up, but you didn't necessarily have an outlet for it. Maybe.
Got it. So to give some more detail on that March retreat. It was based with ayahuasca. So for those who aren't familiar, that is a South American potent psychedelic plant that actually it itself, from my understanding, you combine it with other different plants and it enhances their effectiveness. So I forget which one it's combined with, but in the typical brew form, it's combined with another native South American plant that naturally produces a form of DMT. And so DMT is a compound that actually our bodies produce naturally. It's a very potent psychedelic, and the highest levels of it that we produce naturally are right at birth and right before death. So do with that what you will. And typically DMT is smoked, and it's a very, very intense high, but only lasts about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But the version with ayahuasca, it lasts about 5 hours. And so it is similar to like a very, very high dose mushroom trip. But one of the things that they told us during our orientation for the ayahuasca retreat was that more than any other psychedelic, it's notorious for being unpredictable. Like, it's no two trips are ever the same. They can be wildly different. But what you can be sure of is that it's going to show you something you need to see. So one of the interesting things that the woman running the retreat told us was like, you know, well, I'll back up for a second. So ayahuasca is notorious for also being a purging medicine. Like, you're physically releasing things that no longer serve you. So that can take the form of vomiting, but it doesn't have to. It can also be crying, shivering, or shaking. It could be yawning. It can be flatulence. It can be bowel movements, like any of that. So what she, one of the first things she told us was like, you know, me and my co-facilitator are here looking out for you. If it seems like someone else is having a rough time, don't worry about them. That's our job. Like, you know, stay focused on your own experience. And if you're
longer really, that, like somebody's over there just dying and you're like, oh yeah, they got them.
Well, but the point she was, the point that she explicitly made was, if you can't focus on your own experience because this is going on with someone else, that's probably reflective in your regular life too. You probably put others' needs ahead of your own, and you can't like focus internally when the time comes. So she was like, with like when you're on your psychedelic journey here, you might be blasted through the dimensions of time and space to go hang out with aliens. You might have conversations with your dead relatives, or nothing might happen. Like, you might just sit there and the entire time and you don't see anything. Like, nothing really feels different. She's like, but I can promise you whatever you experience will be something that you need. And so the specific thing that I wanted to get out of it was some processing of some early childhood traumatic experiences, which we can get into the details of if you like. But basically, the first night of the retreat primarily was an incredibly joyful, like loving, connected, happy experience. Like, it was really, really powerful experience of love. And then on the second day before we did the night's trip, we did a breath workshop. And so we practiced something called clarity breathing, which is where every single inhale was supposed to mimic a gasp of surprise. So like, and so I initially had some huge resistance to that, because I was like, everybody knows mouth breathing is the worst thing you can do. Like, why would we do this? And we're going to do that for an hour. And so she did tell us, she's like, it's going to be really uncomfortable at first. She's like, just keep going. You will get used to it. As you continue to do it, you're going to, you might feel temperature changes. You might feel tingling. You might feel some pains in different areas of the body. When that happens, we'll be walking around. If we see specific areas where you're holding tension, which we probably will, we'll ask if it's okay. Can we like press on those areas, kind of massage them a little bit, help you work through them? If you're not comfortable with that, say no, don't worry about it, no problems. And so we started, and she wasn't lying. At first, it was really uncomfortable, really not pleasant, but kind of got used to it. And before I knew it, she's like, okay, we're halfway done. And then I started feeling this like sharpness and tightness under the right side of my ribs. And so I'm like pressing on it, like trying to hook my fingers on it, kind of massaging that area. And then she comes by and is like, hey, is it okay if I
still, you're breathing?
Exactly. Like, yep. The whole time. And she's like, can I press near your chest and shoulders a little bit? And I was like, sure. So she starts pressing in like kind of right near the outer pec, right about here. And I was like, oh, okay, there's definitely something there that needs to be worked out. So I'm like pushing back against her hand to let her know she can apply some more pressure. And she does, while I'm continuing to do the like, like that. And she starts massaging my upper right trap and then pressing on the right side of my jaw. And then she like gently presses on my right hip, kind of in the TFL area, and just floodgate of tears.
Really?
Wow. So, and for like 15 minutes, I just sobbed my eyes out. And even though I was in front of seven people who I'd known for less than 24 hours, I felt zero sense of self-consciousness whatsoever. Like, it was the most like pure, beautiful experience of sadness that I've ever felt. And it felt so good to release it, to like get all that out of there. And when we shared at the end, after we all shared our experiences, I was like, I had no idea how long that had been trapped inside me and how much of it there still was. Like, I knew that there was something in there that was like my main reason for wanting to do this retreat, but I had no idea how much there was. And I felt physically lighter and just so much better. And I kind of lost my train of thought here, but it was Oh, that's what I was gonna say. It occurred to me after I was like, not only is some of this from like mourning some stuff that happened to me when I was a little kid, like 4 or 5 years old, I was like, some of this isn't even mine. Some of this is from before I was born. And I don't know, I don't have like a logical explanation for how I knew that, but I absolutely knew that. I was like, some of this predates me. And then it was really, really freeing to kind of get all of that out.
That's God, that's such a cool story to be able to talk to, because it's like you hear these things and it's like, I don't know, there's that ephemeral nature of certain things like this, which are once you experience, you're like, oh yeah, then I'm gonna try and put it into words, and then you're just gonna be like, yeah, okay, well, like it never reaches past the individual, but to know you and to like, you're a rational, serious thinker, and
Yeah.
but
For the
what?
longest time, like anti any of this more woo-woo type stuff, you know? Like that was my I would have like hearing this story, like if I had told this story to my, 23-year-old or 24-year-old self instead of 34, I wonder how dismissive I would have been, you know? Like I'd like to think I would have listened, but maybe not.
Yeah, well, there's some of those things where, like, so a question I have is, like, when you say you kind of knew that there was something there that you kind of wanted to get, like, what was that, like, that gnosis, that awareness? Like, how would you describe that prior to?
Well, so this wasn't necessarily just the day of. This is something I've been
And that's what I mean. It's like in the,
this has been like intuition bubbling up for the last almost 2.5 years of like unaddressed emotional pain and trying to do various methods to uproot it. And I'd finally got to the point where I was ready to face it, and that was why ayahuasca appealed to me, because from everything I'd heard and read about it was like you're along for the ride. You don't get to fight back or exercise any sort of control. Like you drink it and you're gonna be on this roller coaster and you're gonna be shown what you need to process.
So, and th this all happened the night before you even did ayahuasca, right?
No, this was between night one and night two. So I think what had happened was the first night of ayahuasca was like such a loving, connected, opening experience that I was just like so ready to let go of any resistance to having this be pulled out of me, because I knew that emotion and everything was there, but it's not like I could have just like sat on my couch and meditated for 10 minutes and be like, okay, I'm ready to feel this now, you know? Like it needed a real intense pattern interrupt to be brought so deeply out. And this actually brings me something that I wanted to ask you about, because Tess, my wife, was reading something a couple weeks ago, and we're trying to re-find it. But she was reading something about the physical markers of emotional trauma being stored in the fascial tissue. Do you know anything about this?
I think so. I don't. I always try to think about questions like this in terms of like pragmatic, like how would that look like? And so, and I think because there's, I kind of have been working on like, if you could describe something with like if there's like the tangential, pragmatic, realistic, real world, so to speak, like the thing that we could touch and interact with. And then there's
Well,
the
can I give you some interesting information on this?
Please.
So one of the mobility projects that I've been working on for this year is the seated pancake. And after the ayahuasca retreat, I'm now able to, after about 30 seconds of warm up, comfortably touch my forehead to the floor in a seated pancake. And 2 years ago, I couldn't even get my elbows to the floor. Like that was, and in the month since doing these two retreats, I've added 3 inches to my vertical jump.
So those I learned more about in my kind of brief experience in some capacity. I think if you think about your body as though you would think about, you have cats, right? You have multiple cats, as you could see the background. Your cat has an intelligence that isn't necessarily like in the
Linguistic.
theoretical, logical. So yeah, it's not it's conscious, but there's a consciousness that is like different than the peak of the iceberg that we kind of think of as our thought.
Right.
And that responds to things in the environment that are subperceptible, that are just, you know, that are there. So like, you know, I may have forgiven you, but my body hasn't, kind of thing. Like, you gotta think about these, the arrangements our body makes with movement, which has slowly kind of led me to this perspective that if someone's body is giving me a certain signal or pain or feedback or stiffness or any type of like movement, you can learn so much just by observing what it is. Then there's a reason for that. And it might not be immediately obvious, but, you know, there's an exploration there. And some of these things, like you said, there is a deep experience that is causing the reason for this bodily position that isn't necessarily just a flippant, oh, I just want to do the stretch. And I think there's an interesting correlation between why some mobility training works for some people sometimes and why most, or it doesn't work for other people other times. And I think it's the pattern interrupt. Like, I don't think that there, so for example, if I were to walk in and, you know, let's say Tess walked in right behind you and scared you, you would have a physical movement. And so it's not hard to think that our psychological experience is mirrored by our physiology. And I think that we're just not necessarily aware of how those things play out in terms of like the smaller, where oxygen gets transferred to the body and where movement happens. And if movement doesn't happen, you'll get the hyaluronic acid and it creates these fascial adhesions, which are basically dehydrated areas. And then you could see a pattern would develop over time. And I had a specific experience where like a lot of stress and stuff, and then my body, I actually shrunk a half inch. And so I was 6'1".
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, and I remember because when I was a kid, I got up, I always wanted to be 6'2", and I was 6', which is, you know, it's like, I want to be a millionaire, but I was only 900,000-aire, whatever. Yeah. But 6'1¾". I always remember that because I wanted to be 6'2". And then sometime after college, I had like a back injury and my shoulder injuries, some ankle sprains. So I had some injuries. So I basically lost a lot of confidence, but I got stiff. My body wasn't feeling good. I went to the doctor. It was like 24, 25, and I was like 6'1". I'm like, what? When did I lose 3? And this is a prideful thing. I remember like, what do you, and it, but that was the way it was for years. And then I started doing the, you know, it's been about 2 years now, but I started doing the fascial stuff, working with Gary, and really started to think of the body in terms of like, it's either a compressive suit, like your fascial suit's either shrinking and compressing, or it's expanding and growing, and remeasure it to 6¾". And it makes you start to understand that, you know, things like working on vertical jump happened often when you let go of the resistance that's keeping yourself down, as opposed to trying to add more. And I think those kind of things that you're doing, like, it's a weird thing. So yeah, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think that was really well said. And kind of like the two conclusions I drew, is I also, in the aftermath of that first retreat, have felt much less of a pull towards sweets in particular, which had kind of always been like my drug of choice. So what I realized was that holding all that emotion in, even though I didn't really know I was consciously doing that, took energy. Like, and not only did it take energy, there was some like physical contraction, like restriction components to it. So like no longer needing to spend the energy holding it inside, and no longer having as tight of restriction, as much contraction around the hips, freed up both additional energy and movement, and it no longer needed to be soothed by something like repeated sugar indulgences.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting too about like, so the pancake stretch is basically, for people who can't visualize it, you sit on the ground, your legs straight out, like kind of in a...
Like that in a V.
Fold forward. But there is a direct correlation between your pelvic floor and your diaphragm. In fact, they're like the two ends of the, like the sphere, whatever, the column that is the top and the bottom of the can that is your abdomen. And that's directly, your diaphragm is directly related to your tongue. And I'm just thinking about some of these breathing things and the sobbing. It's like this kind of like convulsive, like lung diaphragmic contraction that then plays into this like deep movement. So, you know, the pressing in under the right rib, what I don't think people, you'll say, well, my hips are there, but it's like they don't perceive the tissue around the spine as including the pelvic floor, your diaphragm, all the deep visceral fascia or parietal or parietal, whatever you call it, fascia, the deep fascia around the organs, the ligaments and stuff around your spinal cord, and then all the way up into like the things around your esophagus, because your esophagus and your trachea is a little bit firmer, but like all the tissue, that's not like hard per se. It's really wrapped. And so if your throat's constricted, you know, the people will have, you can tell the tone of someone's, the tenor of someone's voice in a sense where like, you know, there's a raspiness when they like they get, you know, they constrict your throat. And I, just another way of thinking about this is I always like the old saying to take a walk in someone else's shoes. You know, if you see somebody walking and you try to mimic them, you'll get a sense for how their body expresses itself. You try to talk like the way they talk. And it's really interesting that whether or not there's just I think what was cool is you were consciously willing to just let go of your bodily control.
Yeah.
And just, that's what I think is there's that what's cool is you pressed into your right molar, right? Right cheek.
Yeah.
I don't
masseter area.
I don't know enough about this, but I did see this video of this guy who's brilliant. He basically was showing people, he put them on his table, have them try to do internal hip rotation. And then he would have them feel the heel, the molar, and the peripheral vision on that side and connect. Okay. So they put a heel cup or like put their heel on the ground, press into it, bite down on some like tongue depressor with their molar, and then like work on, like you can wave your fingers to the side of your eye to get your peripheral vision. And immediately they would have their hip or internal rotation just open up. And it was as though I've been doing a weird experiment of my own. So I'm 3.5 weeks into no contacts. So yeah. I dropped down to just like glasses that are like half magnification, basically from 3.25x to 2x, and then some one. But all in the intention of learning to trust my body. And so just even having some awareness of where your left or your right peripheral vision is, there's like where your side of your body is. And there's so many things that, it's hard to even begin to describe it because you could listen to this and feel just overwhelmed with like, where do I even start? But it's like there's a wonder with this that I think if there's a meta narrative of this that you're from your story and from what I'm kind of working through now is that the conscious effort of trying and doing more is often confounding the problem, and that problem is experienced as stiffness in the body, tightness, impingement in the joint, irritation, grinding, all these things. And the effort to do more is often continuing down that path.
Yeah.
The hard part is to know what to let go of. I think that's the real challenge.
No, that was very well said.
Because if you knew what to let go of, you would let go of it. But everything, that's it. So I've been thinking.
Here's go ahead.
I was going to say, just as an analogy, the blind spot. It like the thing that you need to let go of exist in the blind spot, which is the thing that you think you already have. And so literally, it's like, you know, for me, it's just the vision analogy is not lost. But like, the blind spot of like, all right, it's the thing that you think is your strength. Like, let go of that. And you're probably going to have some tailbone of, which for you is emotional control. Like, you are one of the most stoic, you know, there's level-headed, you know, you're unflappable. Like, it's interesting because I hear stories about you as a younger guy playing soccer, and I definitely, it sounds like you're a little bit more like emotional and like hot-headed and competitive and stuff like that. And as far as I've known you, I mean, I didn't even know you when you had long hair, but like now, like, pride yourself on this, like, to a certain extent, the intellectual capacity, the ability to have lecture, like to be presented as just a set of rational facts and logic as opposed to a messy human. And I think that's an interesting piece for you to let.
I'm plenty messy, but
from an outside, you wouldn't know that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's fair.
You let go of that emotional composure and just sob. Like, that's something that even if your 24-year-old self would have been like, yeah, I definitely think that's there, they'd be like, but there's no way in hell I'm gonna do that. Like,
yeah,
like that's very true. It's something took you 34 years to be able to say, yeah, let's cry in front of people.
Yeah. No, that's a very, very good point.
That's amazing stuff. Okay, so have you – I'm always interested. So I did a mushroom trip about 3.5 weeks ago. That's been a –
I didn't know this.
I tried to do it. It's been too long since I did one, but that's – it the thing about that I always value is you get hit with a very realistic thing of like, you know, here's the hard questions. Like, I can't hit with the question of like, why can't I see? But you don't get to think in the superficial terms of like tomorrow and, you know, yesterday. You think all it is sun up, day, me, here, breathe. Like, that's all it is. So you deconstruct and it's like, if I didn't have all this constructed framework about the rest of my life, all I would be thinking about is, why can't I see? Why is that blurry? What? And I would just be upset. Like, I would be, why? How could I move past that? And I think there's a different way of experiencing that kind of same empathy for yourself as a child that I'm working through, which is just to wax philosophical on it. Imagine little 2-year-old Graham sitting in front of the TV screen really close watching Barney because he loves Barney. It's amazing. Barney, I love you. It's like you feel like you belong. It's the whole thing. And the kids just watch TV because you're in it. It's like a real world thing. And then your parents are like, stop watching TV. And you go to the doctor and the doctor measures your eyes and somehow you get told you're farsighted. And maybe you just hadn't developed your eyesight because you're 2 and maybe you weren't outside that much or whatever it is. And just maybe there was a weakness. Who knows? But now you have this thing in your glasses. And so your system, the system, like me as a 2-year-old Graham, like my body, my system, could comprehend enough information with what I could see. Meaning the stimuli, let's just say with quote unquote perfect eyesight, I could get 100% of stimuli. But with my eyesight, I could get about 60%. Let's just say whatever. That's what my system could comprehend. The speed of life would have moved at that pace until I developed more capacity. But I give you a crutch or a solution, so to speak, that then speeds you back up to 100%. Now, my system is expected to process twice the information that it would have otherwise had. And then what you get is a brain that starts to fire rapidly, more and more information, more thought, more process, and it's constantly running hamster wheels to keep up. Yet my system, my body, my physical awareness and knowing is left behind. Because it's getting so much input. And so it creates this anxiety where I don't know how to trust my body to handle things. So I keep a very strong grip on life. You know, you see a very right side dominant, left hemisphere dominant of the brain, right side dominant of the body. It's like, I'm going to control all these things. I'm going to think. I'm going to be smart, analytical. And letting go of that, you know, what is it? That was the big question is like, what does it look like to trust myself? Yeah. What is it like? I don't know. But that letting go of I know how to do all these things. I know the answer. I know it's like, I don't know. And so I'm going to have to messiness. And how do you sit in that messiness best? Take away the thing that's crutching the thing that is the underlying true reflection of what your system can handle and just accept that and be there with that. And, you know, the question is, I still have readers. And so I don't have to make this like a dogmatic thing, but like I have readers if I need to look at a computer or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, just even questioning something like, oh, I could actually see pretty well in a lot of capacity. And there's so many things like that, that my body has felt like a different expression, like an emotional awareness. And it went back to like being able to let go of the thing that I prided myself on, which is the analytical prowess to figure everything out, be smart and always have the answer to like, you know, I had this, the thought, the kind of codified thought at the end of it, which was my poor eyesight is a gift because it forces me to confront the reality that in order to know anything, you have to be really up close. Like, I don't know what to tell you about foreign wars and political interventions and things around. All I know is that I have to spend some time with you and be up close to you to actually know it. And that is not the way I always like to do, you know, when I was in college. My thing is I tell you why, you know, at the time I was very fundamentalist in terms of more Christian perspectives. I could tell you why drugs are bad, being gay is wrong, you shouldn't have sex. I could tell you all these things with all the great. I could give you the truth of the world. But now I'm like, if I see you, I have to be really up close and it's messy and I probably don't know. So, but anyways, it goes back to like being able to sit with the thing you most don't want to do in some capacity in order to allow something else to express itself. Is that track?
100%. Because I kind of, one of the things that has been a area of interest for me in the past few years is around the concept of identity, and that if you want to understand somebody's behavior, particularly if it doesn't seem to make sense, look at which identity they're protecting.
Ooh.
Like which identity that do they most cherish?
Uh-huh.
And because the more deeply held an identity is, if it faces a strong challenge or like direct counter evidence, So the great example for me was like my biggest identity for the longest time was good soccer player.
Yeah.
And so like the reason why I was such a hothead on the field is if somebody like showed me up or got the better of me or did this thing that is in direct contradiction to this identity. And so then I have to reassert that identity. And you do that like when an identity is threatened and deeply threatened sometimes, like you can respond with a level of hostility, aggression, or grief as if your life was actually in yeah. danger, because that's what you see yourself as. And so as I unpacked this more and more, I kind of came to the belief that our core identity, if we can find it, if we go deep enough, the identity we hold most dear is based on a belief and fear that the opposite is true. So after I picked away enough layers, what I realized that what my general, my most cherished identity was that of general competence. Like if there was something that I would put a lot of time into or was something that was considered societally important or desirable, I wanted to be seen as very good at it.
Mm.
And that was masking a deep, deep fear and belief that no matter what, I would never be good enough.
All right. Let me run this thought by you.
Yeah, please.
Because what I think is interesting is to position yourself on one end of the spectrum, good soccer player or bad soccer player. But the reality is you position yourself at some point of the spectrum. And so you could see fear of success being rejecting facts that would point counter to the positive, to the negative side, which is actually better than you say you are. No, I'm not. Look, I can't even stand on one foot. Mm-hmm. But fear of failure would be rejecting facts that are worse than, maybe it's backwards, I don't know. Feel failure would be rejecting facts that you're worse than you are in a sense. And so, you know, what's interesting is there's a fixed point of, because you said very good at things, not the best at things. That's a different mindset of like, you know, and so what's interesting is that the fixed nature of where we would perceive ourselves on some hierarchy of things is the thing that we fight to hold on to. And the question is, that whether or not, I guess there's two things. One, was that ever true at any point ever? Or, you know, people can change. And so it's like, I don't know. Like, what would you think of that? Like, do you think that there's a resistance to change that is part of that? Or is it more of like...
For the identity?
Yeah, because I imagine as you change, there's a resistance to that change. It just happened because...
Totally. Like, so, like... Here, an interesting way to start to unpack this is like, look at, so you said when you were in college, you like, you know, you had these beliefs, could see the world this way. And a lot of it was like through a Christian lens.
Yeah. Very very specifically like a Southern Methodist, kind of Southern Baptist Christian
view. How would you have reacted, do you think, if somebody whose opinion you cared about was like, you're a fake Christian, like you're not, like you have no idea what you're talking about, you're a hypocrite, like you're full of shit?
You try to then do a character attack of like, right, who are you to say that, you know?
So like, well, you wouldn't have laughed it off, right?
It depends on what grounds they were saying that, which, you know, you'd have to say like, it would have been like, let's just say, you're not a real Christian because this is a lot of judgment you have for people, and it's not really your job to judge other people, especially if they're doing the best they can. And the question is like, well, you know, it would have been I would have made a call to like, it's an appeal to, not appeal to authority, maybe appeal to authority, appeal to like rightness in a sense of like, well, let's just go look at this, what the Bible says, you know, and I would have found, yeah, an appeal to authority. So that's what I would have like looked outward to say, oh, well, this is why, you know, I'm doing the best.
So you would have had to reassert to them that you were in fact a good Christian, or like you probably wouldn't have just ignored them and let it slide.
Yeah, at that point. And definitely at college, it was a sliding scale. I started to kind of like experience other people. I'm like, oh.
Whereas like now, if somebody was like, if you got someone in the DM, somebody like, you're not a very good Christian. Like,
it's to the point now where I don't actually, I put so much weight on what it actually means to be like, I don't even know if I would call myself a Christian now because
that's the exact point. It is no longer a part of your identity worth defending. right?
The meta truth of like, are you a truth seeker or like, are you doing the best? Like, are you actually like, you know, are you a fraud? Are you lying or something like that? That's closer to it. But like, I now, yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm going with it.
Well, and it's kind of like, and I'm gonna steal an exact thing from Gabor Mate, who we wanted to talk, who we'll get to a little bit later, but he was talking about like, you know, if you have a very ridiculous, if somebody says to you something totally ridiculous, like, dude, that like third ear on your forehead's really ugly, you should get it removed. You're like, what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't bother you. You don't suddenly think like, oh, what can they see that I can't? Should I get this checked out? You know what I mean? Like, it's not, there's no agenda there whatsoever. But if like you were raised in a household where like appearance was really important and somebody's like, dude, you're like packing on some pounds, like you should like, you know, do some more cardio, that could really sting, you know, like that could really be upsetting. Yeah. You have this identity, this view of yourself as like fit, muscular, lean, desirable person, whatever, and someone's like, you're kind of chubby, like that could really, really bother you. It could feel much more threatening than it actually is. So I think a huge path to like happiness and freedom is be on the lookout for those triggers and then explore them when you find them. And when someone shows it to you, like that's a huge gift that they've given you, because you've been like, whoa, this is, I didn't know that I thought this of myself. And there's like a really easy exit door from all this too, so you don't turn stuff into an identity, is just be like, yeah, sometimes, you know. So if I see myself as really, really intelligent, someone's like, dude, you're like, you're not very smart, I'd be like, yeah, sometimes, you know.
Like, dude, I do, if you say so, you know. It's kind of like, if it's, well, not,
I think even, but if you say so, like, I get it, it does the same thing, but it also, it kind of is like dismissing their opinion. Whereas if you're like, I am sometimes intelligent and I am sometimes not, that's so like bland of a statement that it's not worth using any energy to defend. You know, you can be like, yeah, that's probably true. So
you, there's like, yeah, sometimes it's great because it's like, yeah, you're true in fact. But if it's something like somebody else, I think if it's a statement someone makes about themselves, then it's like, if you say so, is reiterating, like, if you say, I think that's, yeah. There are two different circumstances. I like that a lot. Yeah, yeah, that's really good. God, you said something, I've heard this said before, and I think it's true. The things you hold sacred, the beliefs you hold sacred, are the things you won't laugh about. So, and this is the funny thing, is I'll like talk to people, and I'll put up on occasion, I'll put up something, and you get a really, if you ever get a chance to like, you know, look at people's DMs that they send when they think that they're not talking to like a real person per se, people will say certain things and it's like, oh, I've triggered something. But when it's on text written down, it's like, it's almost divorced from the emotion that they want to have. And it's very interesting insight to that, because you get people it's hard to like take this out. Like, I don't know if it's theory of mind is the correctness, but like the awareness of yourself, is that what theory of mind means? Like, it's just an awareness of the fact that you're thinking.
My understanding is like, yeah, like awareness of what you're thinking, or trying to put yourself into the shoes, see what someone else is thinking, right? Like,
so then I'm correct. It's hard to have the theory of mind to remember that the thing that you most seem to grow on, where you will feel most justified in acting like it's not okay. Like, you know, whatever it is, gun laws, abortion, whatever you think is the thing that is like, you're gonna feel the most like justified. But you don't understand, because of this. I mean, there's people with the Ukraine Russia stuff, the Israel Palestine stuff. It's like, they, people will come at you like, well, it's obviously this. And I'm like, do you actually know that? And yeah. If you did, it's like, it's really interesting, because people, it's hard, because you will feel justified. You will feel as though that is true. And you have to almost, I guess that maybe the real meta narrative and the meta skill is to be able to question yourself. That's why I really think.
100%. Like, if I have become more and more convinced that a willingness to like ruthlessly question your own thoughts and beliefs, mm-hmm. and be like, well, what if that wasn't true? Like, and have openness to that and willingness to go there, while it initially might sound really, really scary and destabilizing, that is where freedom is found.
Like, the so I had this weird actually the morning of the mushroom trip. So, but I was at the track and I've been working on like my big toe mobility, which is, you know, mm-hmm. the only reason I just noticed is like it's a lot stiffer. I can't really extend it. So I was like, let me just try and actually like stretch and work on that. And so I could feel some stretching going up in that like medial calf area. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was like a week or two of kind of working on that. And then I was at the track and doing 200s. And then the fifth one, I felt like, well, that's definitely really stiff in there. I was like, I'm just knock out this last one, just get it done. And so then I went halfway through the last one and popped. And so since then, it's been a little on and off. And I had some calf issues last year. Right. And I sent a message to Mark. And, you know, of course, remember, I'm the barefoot sprinter. So, of course, I have a pseudonym to protect. But, you know, I sent a message to Mark. I was like, well, you know, when I started the running, I was all on turf or like grass fields for a long time. And then it only wasn't really, I didn't like add it. I didn't really move it to the track or like hard surfaces until, you know, when I moved out here about 2 years ago. And so, you know, even in that time, it's still a relatively early time for the body to be adjusting that, specifically if I'm also doing jujitsu and other aspects where it's like a lot of contraction versus a lot of extension. And, you know, Mark sent me this message like, well, I don't know. Have you really thought about like whether humans are meant to be running, like sprinting on that kind of a hard surface? And it was an interesting thing, which is like the part of me that wants to protect my identity. Oh, yeah, of course. But the other part is like, well, what if I just sit with that for a second? I'm like, you know what? I just feel the impulse to protect that. Like, you don't understand. We can sprint anywhere because we're goddamn barefoot people. Like, whatever it is, I don't know, there's just some silliness to that. But I was like, yeah. I will never learn anything if I think that I know all this stuff. And, you know, I think that there's a reality of like, that's a lot of pressure to be, you know, at some capacity. You think, well, I don't necessarily think the spikes or those minimal shoes help that much. But I do think that if you are, I think the real value is if you're actually going to sprint on hard surfaces, it's, you know, being able to do strides and sprints on grass or turf is one thing. And I think it's about twice. It's like a big jump up to go sprints on hard surfaces. I think there's like a, and that's not something that I really had honored in that fact before. And I don't know, I'd like to think that you could continue to develop the capacity, but maybe there is something with flat, perfectly flat surfaces that like, it's just so much, I don't know, but like, I'll never learn if I have this bias. I'm like, well, that can't be the case. Like, why? Because you're
there. Yeah, totally. And like, and it kind of goes to that extremist thinking too, is that like, it can be very easy to fall into the trap of like, well, if I admit that it's not ideal to sprint on a concrete surface, then barefoot running has no value. If it's not applicable in every situation, it has no value. And it's like, well, no, that's not true. You know, like.
And I do think that there's something to be said for, I enjoy doing it and it's interesting. But like, if I were to run it, if I wanted to run faster times, it would probably worse it. Like, I don't know if I tell someone else to go sprint to do any of the running workouts barefoot, other than strides and learning how to run. And like, I think there's a value there, but it's like, and I think some people have to take things to an extreme in some capacity to really like test and see things. Cause then they are able to say, yeah, let me take 10% off this and, you know, really bring that back. There's something there, but it's like, it is that idea of like, whatever you think is your identity. And what's interesting though, is if you scale this down into, okay, so let's say take the theory of mind, which is my new favorite term now. For someone that doesn't necessarily have the wherewithal to be asking these questions, right? It's sometimes hard to put into perspective the things that people have built their identity around. You know, like looking back, you might have, you know, saying, well, I just all I wanted to be was a soccer player at that point. You know, so maybe I'll ask you this question. Do you think that these kind of fixed perspectives serve us at times? So like if you could go back and tell your 24-year-old.
Undoubtedly, yes. That's why we adopt them, because they serve us. And actually, this transitions really nicely into some of the Gabor Mate stuff that I wanted to talk about. So for anybody who's not heard of him, he is a Canadian physician, very famous for his work with addicts. And he recently wrote a book called The Myth of Normal that is my new favorite thing of all time.
Okay. The book or the general thesis?
Book. Everybody should read the book. as broad as sweeping a statement as that is, like it, the lessons contained within are invaluable. And one of the really interesting things he talks about is that the push-pull between one of the conditions of being a modern human is the battle between attachment and authenticity. So getting our needs met and feeling like we are being unmasked, who we truly are, showing ourselves exactly as we are, not having to try to change ourselves for anyone other or to fit in, and getting our needs met.
Yeah. And
he said, when you are a child, attachment has to win that battle because it is crucial to your survival.
Yeah.
And so even if something like, you know, the first time you throw a temper tantrum in public and then you get a really angry reaction from your parents, and you subconsciously, whether or not it's the lesson your parents meant to impart, you subconsciously learn, it's not okay to be like this. I am not okay. I will not receive love if I am like this.
Yeah.
And so we then learn we have to change part of who we are in order to receive love and to have our needs met.
Yeah. There is a natural aspect because some of those things are like trying to save us, or
let me keep going with it. So the problem with those things that we learn is we've internalized this belief before we have the capacity for logical reasoning and thought. And so what becomes like changing ourselves in certain scenarios as a coping strategy as a very young child becomes a subconscious default mode of operating as an adult. And at the time, it very much did serve our needs. Because I'm gonna basically paraphrase him here is like, unless you grew up in a household where your parents both consistently reinforced the message, I will always love you unconditionally, no matter what, no matter when I'm upset with you, no matter if I'm sad, no matter if I'm angry, no matter if I'm tired, no matter if you're angry, no matter what, I will love you. It doesn't mean I won't get annoyed with you or angry with you, but my love for you is unbreakable, unchangeable, no matter what. Unless you get that reinforced so much that you wholeheartedly believe it, which I'd venture to say almost nobody does, you are going to internalize beliefs that you have to be a certain way to receive love.
Yeah.
And so in many cases, like depending on the degree of emotional trauma, unresolved issues and baggage that your parents bring to, you know, the child rearing process, you may have to change yourself a lot. And those changes saved your life. They allowed you to function, because the other thing that he said, which I thought was incredibly insightful, was we pick up in a very intuitive, non-intellectual, rational way as young children, we pick up on our parents' emotional traumas and inability to provide needs. And so he said we can draw two conclusions at that point. We can say my caregiver is incapable of meeting my needs as is, which he said is a life-threateningly terrifying realization for a young child that we will run from. Or we say they're like this because of me. And if I work hard and change, things could be different.
Yeah.
And because that is a very egocentric time period when that, like that belief develops around the age of where, like, if, you know, a kid covers his eyes and is like, you can't see me. You know, it's like their perspective is the only one.
Yeah.
What?
You don't have object permanence yet.
Yeah. It's like all the stuff that is very, you know, self-focused. So we internalize like issues of our parents as our own fault and think we need to change them.
Yeah.
How we need to change ourselves. And so he's like, the problem is that programming, that conditioning lives on much after it has saved our life. So he said he calls those beliefs and patterns our stupid friends. He said they saved our life, but they're incapable of learning and growing, and they definitely haven't realized we don't need them anymore.
Yeah.
So it's like part of your work as an adult is to identify that programming, how it influences you, and see it clearly so that you don't need to be beholden to it.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's beautiful, because at the very least, it pulls apart the, or it, it, it creates a space where the question can go, well, maybe the way that I perceive things isn't necessarily optimal or ideal, and maybe there's some things that are, you know, negatively affecting me. I like that. That's really good. Okay, so, and this might be a slight side thing. Other than like the obvious thing, which is there's some pain. Okay, so my theory of mind, my favorite word. You know, it seems that there are some people that are burdened with a sensitivity of awareness to these things that then creates pain, and they're aware of the stiffness in their body, the pains of their body. The thoughts, the stiffness and pains of their beliefs and thoughts, and that creates enough of an incentive that like the resolution of such issue is valuable in and of itself. Meaning, what's the point of all this therapy you're doing? Well, because my life without therapy is a broad term, but like physical therapy, whatever. What's the point of all this self-work you're doing? Well, because before I was doing it, I was in pain, and now I'm in less pain, or whatever it is. And inner constriction.
Yeah.
But from that, for people who don't seem to have the self-awareness of their body and their emotions or their thoughts, they just don't, I don't know how to say it, like, they're just a few degrees disconnected from an internal experience. And I don't know if anybody is truly that, or if they've kind of, maybe as you say, they learned as a kid that any acknowledgement of their internal experience puts them in an unsafe space.
This probably isn't perfectly true, but I think it's a decent rule of thumb is that like the greater the degree of disconnection, the greater the degree of emotional pain and trauma that's not yet been processed.
Yeah.
Because I'll give you a good example on this. Like, remember when I had you use the newbie device?
Okay.
So one time I worked with a guy who I eventually had to tell him, or I told him after the first session, I was like, I think you need to find a practitioner who can help you daily, because there's like, you know, this too much work to be done. I had to turn it up to about 55% before he could even feel it.
Oh my gosh. I felt it like 5%.
Yeah, you felt it right away. And most people will at least feel some sort of tingling by 10%. And most people their first time using it will be very uncomfortable at 30%. Like, please don't go any higher. And he didn't feel anything until 55%. And he said he was at like a 5 out of 10 intensity in the mid-80s. For those who haven't used this, like, that is an unbelievable amount of physical sensation on your body. Like, it is, anyway, hard to describe.
Just like, but to really put that down there, because I think that's a valuable thing to help people visualize. But like, you're putting these things that just transmit some level of electric stimulation to get the muscles to contract. And it's not only painful, but it feels like your muscles are squeezing and contracting if you can connect with them. And it's like, and that's very uncomfortable. And there's also a shocking sensation for things that don't connect well. So like, it's like you're being convulsed and electrocuted at the same time. And I was feeling that like nothing.
It has a lot of therapeutic benefit when used the right way as well.
It is a torture device.
But anyway, most of the time, the people who can take an absurd amount of the current on the workout setting in particular are high level bodybuilders, like people who are used to like pushing themselves through intense physical discomfort through exercise, have very well developed muscles, that kind of stuff. The fact that this guy could get up into the 80% his first time using it was not because he was an extremely conditioned athlete. It's because he was so desensitized that he could barely feel anything. Hold on. My wife called me twice in a row. I'll be right back.
Of course. We'll pause. Here I am sharing my thoughts. Future Graham will listen to this. Future Graham will be listening to how amazing and intellectual present Graham is. What a gift it is to be listening to President Graham. They wax philosophically. With Greg. Greg the Catman. Catman do. Catman don't. Catman didn't.
All right. Thank goodness for editing, right?
Oh yeah. So it's back.
All right. Well, let me send this message and then I'm back.
Do you remember when Tiana did it? I feel like she was like she could handle a lot. I remember that.
Yes. She got up. I think she got up into the 40s or 50s her first time with her shoulder. Yeah. And like, there's an interesting thing when I work with somebody for the first time who's like high above average in terms of the level of current they can take, that's usually usually indicative of a degree of disconnection from the body.
Very much. Like she'll be stressed with all these emotional experiences. And I'm like, hey, you did. She's like, no, I'm not. I'm like, oh. Like there is, but it should be mushroom trips. She's starting to like come in and be able to put her thoughts together and like think about things and like really feel when she would get stressed, she would just completely like shut down. It's like there's a whole level of coming out that's happening with that. That's pretty cool. So, but it's interesting to see that.
Or there was another example of a woman I worked with who had an autoimmune condition that led to some like nerve dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And so we measured progress by, after weeks of working together, she would start to feel things, you know, like 30% earlier than she had before. So that was indicative of like nerves coming back online. Whereas if I'm working with somebody in like a more hypertrophy focused capacity, it's like, how much can you take? Like how high can we turn it up?
What's interesting, the bodybuilding aspect. So one of my clients now he's gotten to a point where like, I think he got over to like very much like shut off so much of a stimulation of the body that it's all like screaming and coming back online. He's like very sensitive. His fascial is completely fascial suit is very dehydrated. He's like lost a lot of ability to move, but what we're really trying to get is like these very basic things, like go outside, sit in the ground, feel things, breathe, and like connect with your body. But the reason that drove him to bodybuilding in some sense was like, there's a, I'm not good enough, I need to be perfect. And you get judged by these kind of like nebulous standards of, yeah, I like that guy. I like that guy. Nah, not you. And it's like that's the thing he said, eventually got him to hate bodybuilding. He was like, he was a big guy, like 270 at the time. And it was like, you know, it just really destroys your sense of confidence that you work for years. It's like, and you know, it's like your muscles are screaming, but it's like, I'm not good enough. I'm gonna force you to change. So you almost like from a deep level of, I don't know, like self-rejection that you then move forward in this training. I think there's something interesting about the style of training people choose, but okay. So yeah. So the newbie thing, but basically the disconnect. So, okay. So which brought back to the point of like, you think it's not too far off to say that the disconnect of the body, that like just because you're not, there's almost like clearing out. For example, if you want to, you go into a room of a house of a hoarder, someone's got like just rooms that stuff and stuff out of, before you can even like clean the house, you have to do a bunch of work to get rid of the stuff. You have to create space.
Totally.
So that idea of space, I think, is interesting. I've been thinking about that a lot. Is like space in some capacity is a privilege. Like the space to be able to move and separate joints and move into like articulate, but also the space, the thing that makes the room you're in the most valuable is the space, not the stuff in it. It's the space between, because you get a bunch of stuff, but if you have no room to maneuver, then it's valueless. You know. But I like the space. It's like you have to almost give yourself the space to perceive and hear and think, to separate signal from noise. Okay. I just love that. We could continue down the path of like, you know, discussing that. But I guess that makes, that answers the question I have, which is like, well, actually, I'll say this. Do you think every retract. The question I've been kind of like tackling, because anytime I my human garage friends and I'll go spend time with them, but a lot of people that are in this like healing therapeutic side, rehabilitative side, there's all this talk about healing. We're going to grow, we're going to heal. And it's almost like, and then what? You know, I was like, what's the, I remember I would sit around with them where there was this dinner party. It was with the human garage people and they had a bunch of their practitioners. People came in to hang out for this. And we're like, oh, we're healing. We're doing it. And it's like, they talk about, I'm fixing this. I found this problem. I'm opening this tissue up. I'm moving this. And it's like, it's an intoxicating path of like solving the problems, unwinding your body, unlocking your potential. And like, it's very, it's luscious language that kind of moves you along this path. Like, oh, I think at some level can be another way of self-berating. Like, I have so many problems. I have all these things. Cause I'm like, I always would ask them, like, what's the point in some sense? It's like, what happens after? Because like someone, they win their battle with cancer, but they die anyways. You know, it's like, there's a level of cognitive dissonance I think we hold about some of these things. So I guess the point is, it's like, I don't know how to ask this without going to the extreme, but like, do you think there's like a growth trajectory of humanity that by people taking ownership of their internal experience and doing this, like you said, there was something that wasn't yours that you were letting go of and the crying experience, like, does this change your perspective about like humanity in terms of a trajectory, if there's a purpose, if there's meaning, or is it all just trying to make things more in union?
So I think I've said before on one of these, maybe not, I'll repeat myself if so, unashamedly, that I view meaning and meaninglessness as two sides of the same coin. Yeah. And meaninglessness in an overarching sense offers us the freedom to create our own meaning, which is like the coolest form of freedom in the world. Like, you get to choose what to care about and what to do. And so the point of healing, and I really like Dr. Monte's definition of it, is just a return to wholeness. So being no longer being fractured, feeling like you have to hide parts of yourselves, like being as you truly are, you're no longer using up the energy required to maintain this like false sense of separation or push down parts of yourself or deal with pain. And when all that energy is now freed up, your creative potential to do whatever you like is limitless. Like, you can now pour yourself wholeheartedly into whatever passions move you. And through my entire exploration through all this, I've become ever, ever more convinced that the true essence of humanity, our essence, is love. And it's so easily covered up when we're in pain. And the greater degree of pain, the less likely we are to be in touch with love. But when that is like no longer being pushed down and so clearly felt and experienced, now your ability to express yourself in your own unique way is uninhibited. And that is a beautiful thing. And I think there is so much human potential and creativity right now locked up in dealing with pain and making ends meet. And once like those two things are taken care of for a person, then they can truly show like what they have to offer. And that's so freaking cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think about this a lot in terms of like grand narratives in some capacity, because it's like so many people, it seems to me, you rely on the real places of heaven and hell, like the story that you're going to go to heaven, you're going to go to, as though they're meaning like separate from this existence. Like, there will be, you'll leave this and go out there. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's like heaven and hell serves as very valuable in directional points of like, yeah, I've seen heaven on earth and I've seen hell on earth. Like, I've seen both of those things, and they're the things you aim at and you can work towards. And I always thought about the question of like, you know, if, especially when I was in college, is the thing I started thinking about more, is like, if Jesus came down right in front of you and sat down and said, hey, everything about the Bible is true, except there's no heaven and hell. When you die, you die. But like, you know, you get to be alive, and this is amazing. Like, would that change the way people act? And I think that like is the ultimate litmus test for like, if it would change the way you act, then that should, I think that's like a, it would point to an either a fundamental misunderstanding of your belief or a fundamental misunderstanding of your intention. And there's something about that, which is, you know, I was sitting with Tiana, we went to brunch the other day and we're just walking around by this park, or not park, this river. And I just got struck with, like, I know that there are definitely places, hotspots, and there's hell on earth, so to speak. But it's like to think that earth isn't like heaven in itself, that yeah. our work as humans is to just contribute to making the place better and better and even more whole. Even if that's just a narrative that they tell you to get you to contribute to this facet, like it doesn't seem to be a made up thing. It seems that if you in a healthy state look at the beauty of a blue sky and green trees and birds, how could you not think that this you're in a body that's heart is beating, your lungs are functioning, all of these things are happening, like the unreal amount of things that you get to experience in just that sheer moment of mundane existence. Like, how could you not think that, wow, this is good. Like, this is really cool that I'm here and this is amazing. And like, just that, like, I would like to feel like that more.
Yeah.
And feel like this sucks and I would be here less. And I don't think that that's an exhaustive, that seems like an inexhaustible directive that you could continue to work towards that. Because if you're doing that, it's a gratitude, that love, I think is probably the yeah. same thing. But to me, I define love as seeing things clearly. Like, just look at the world and see it clearly for what it is, not like, I should do this and this is bad. I can't believe, like, those are the things that cause pain. Like you said, like you let go of these things that you were supposed to do. Yeah. And you just immediately opened up so much more space when you let go of the things you're trying to see and just see what is. I don't know. I don't know if there's an answer to that or if that's even a question, but I just think about that a lot.
No, I think that's really beautiful. And the answer I'd give is that, like, how someone could not is because they're in so much pain that they can't focus on anything else or they can't see past it.
Yeah.
And by healing and processing and releasing and feeling that pain so that it can dissipate, you are then so much more free to, like, just lose yourself in wonder at the majesty of a clear blue sky and be like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And that's the coolest ever thing I've ever seen. And that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And yeah, I think getting to spend more time there sounds awesome. Like, right? Like, sign me up.
To me, it almost seems that there's an irony, which is like, oh, let's call it artificial. I'm obsessed with this word, artificial. Artificial healing. It's like healing for the sake of healing is almost like you're reinforced the fear of success. It's like, I can't actually accept that I've healed. Like, the thing I'll talk to people if they have back problems or back pain, and like, 14 years ago, I had a slip disc and an MRI. I'm like, all right, like, what do you think I should do? I'm like, well, the first thing I think you should do is forget that you ever had that thing happen, because you've made it possible for you to ever actually heal. And you've, like, it becomes an identity, which is, the most fun things, even though it's kind of perverse, are to help people let go of identities that are on the negative side of the spectrum of, like, more broken and loser. You know, it's like,
absolutely,
you know, you're not, but it's really,
even if it's negative, there is a comfort in defining ourselves as something, because, like, there's a reason that the question, who am I, is, like, you know, such an important question within Zen and Eastern religious traditions, and is considered, like, the thing to ask yourself, is because feeling like you don't know who you are can be terrifying and disorienting. And so piling something on top of it and saying, I am this, even if it is, I am broken, I am unlovable, I am X, there is comfort in knowing.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked a couple times, maybe I've brought it up once in a different thing about within the Buddhism tradition, like something called the 10 fetters model, which is like these beliefs to shed to, like, achieve ultimate, for not even achieve, but like to be like the Buddha himself. And the last one is comfort with not knowing.
Yeah.
Last one to go, to be truly deeply comfortable. I don't know and I don't need to. That is the last one, final boss. So, like, that not knowing is terrifying.
So I've been thinking about that in relation to eyesight. Listen, Chaim Gilchrist, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he wrote this long, like, 1500 page book about, like, that's got two volumes, about the hemisphere division. And so the left hemisphere way of summarizing it is that the left hemisphere jumps to a conclusion, the right hemisphere opens to a possibility. And now the corpus callosum, which is this like little piece of tissue between our two hemispheres, mostly does work to prevent to stop one side from stepping in. You know, like basically it creates over communication. And within the eyes, there's an optic nerve that crosses the brain as well. And so if you're looking like the strength of a right eye is direct, you know, the right side of your body, your right eye to your left brain. And so it's not lost on me that most people tend to be right-handed and that there is no genetic or neurological wiring for sightedness. Other than the fact that there's mirror neurons, like we watch the people that grow up doing certain things, but there's not, humans are the only animal or the only entity on earth that is sighted. And the reason that is because, Greg, when you're 3-year-old playing soccer and you kick the ball with the right foot, you're like, oh, this is good. Keep practicing that. And so some adult, and when the game's on the line, your ego's there, you're not going to waste time potentially messing up the other side. So we kind of pick a side and it's optimal. You know, you have one thing, your left hand is good at planting if you're going to kick. So your left foot is good at planting, so to speak. What this does is creates this perspective, oh, that's my weak side, that's my bad side. And so in some capacity, what's not also lost to me is like scoliosis, hypertrophy on one side, strength differences, tendon differences, things that just develop. And in a sense, you get this like crushing one side of your body. And now if you cover up different sides of your eyes, so you limit the vision. So I've been working on this because, you know, a lot of people will have a weaker, you know, if you go on Amazon and look up eye patch, almost all the options are for the right eye.
Interesting.
I didn't think about that until just now, but I remember looking, what if my left eye was stronger? I need to work on it. I don't think that that's as much. It's not as much of an option because I really struggled to find any single left eye patch. Because what they have is the bridge. They have to have a directionality of the eye. Yeah. Forehead. But the point is, I've just been really thinking about this. Is like to trust my left. When I close my, and this might be just, you know, I can't say this is in a post-hoc narrative, but if I open my left eye, there's this sense of like, if I open, you cover my right eye and look at my left eye, there's this more sense of like kind of a dilated, like, oh, that's interesting. There's just stuff here, but I don't necessarily look at the definitive details of, oh, that's that. Mm-hmm. My right eye is like, oh, that's Greg. It's the Kiwi. It's like there's a level of those things. And again, I can't say that that's not influenced by this, but something about this, like learning to trust is like just working on like, you know, left, putting yourself in positions and trusting different things that are outside of your grip, that are outside of the things that you know how to do and feel comfortable in. And I see a lot of corollary to that in the body, specifically with the senses, specifically with eyesight, because that is a part of our brain that's pushed through the skull. And it just seems so like, anytime I can describe like the psychological, spiritual, conceptual side, and then pair that with a physiological expression, like that seems to me to be closely aligned to the truth. But I really like the eyesight thing. It's been working on that. But yeah, that's just a piece of it there. So
no, it's really fascinating stuff for sure. The thing about there being no genetic predisposition to handedness, fascinating.
Yeah, well, that's one of the, you'll go and see this. Oh, these 14 genes are come with somewhat linked, but like, they're trying to come up with a left brain way to say this is why sightedness is, but without looking like, well, it's just because. So the point I was getting to with that is, the trusting. So when you're on, you know, taking a psychedelic or a trip, it seems like you kind of, I don't know what part, I'd be interested in what part of the brain is working, but it seems a little bit more like you're just open to possibility. And I think, you know,
and you want to know something funny on that.
Yeah.
Psychedelics are associated with decreased blood flow to the brain. Not more. They're dissolving the filters a little bit.
Yeah. What I think is interesting is another way of saying that, like the 10th fetter of like being okay with not knowing is just being open to possibility. It's like instead of, because a lot of people are saying, I don't know, it's hard to define like being okay with not knowing and ignorance. Like, well, you could know that. But the other thing is there are things that you could know and it's probably within your wheelhouse. If it's in your interest and your desire and your ability to know, you probably should know it. But there are a whole lot of stuff that you just can't know. And being open to the possibility that there are things that exist, like I found that my growth as an individual has directly correlated to how much gray space I'm willing to tolerate in my life. It's like there is a one-to-one ratio there.
Yeah, love that.
I think, or not to go long in the tooth here, but did you have I want to see the list of things you'd sent me. Let's see. Psychedelic retreats, logistics, got that. Immediate increase in physical performance as a result, got that. Emotional trauma stored, that we got that. Love. Let's finish with the words Grok and Sonder. That'd be a great way to wrap this baby up.
So Grok, G-R-O-K. I read it in a book, like a spirituality focused book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
in a book.
I read it in a book.
In a book. Yeah. Sometimes I read the dictionary for fun. And I thought it was I was like, is this in another language? Like what the hell word is this?
Dodgeball. That's not Anchorman, I think.
It's dodgeball. Okay. Yeah. You know, in some cultures they eat only vomit. I read that once in a book. I thoroughly derailed us here, sorry. So I'm gonna read you the dictionary definition of this, but this I thought this was really cool because this word was made up in a science fiction book in the 60s about a civilization on Mars. And it means to understand something intuitively or by empathy. So to like really, truly, deeply grasp it, not necessarily in an intellectual way. Mm. And so this is a classic example, but I love it. It's like, let's say you had never tasted vanilla ice cream, but you've read every single book on the planet about vanilla. You can, you know, its chemical structure. You could even give a graduate level chemistry lecture on it. Mm-hmm. All of that intellectual knowledge would utterly pale in comparison the second you took your first bite. Yeah. You would have like a deep experiential knowledge that couldn't be replaced by all of that other stuff. And so like some of this stuff that we've described, you know, like these experiences of love or healing or wholeness or pain, they have to be grokked so much as intellectually understood. And I think it's a cool concept, a very useful word.
Do you know the word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, or
no? I've heard of it, yeah.
Is that, would you, that seems pretty similar in that capacity?
Maybe. I don't know if I'm, I guess maybe I'm not familiar enough to, but there's something interesting on that. So like the early Christian Gnostics had psychedelic rituals.
I've been just listening to Paul Stamets on a Rogan talking about all those things, and it's just like some of those. The more you learn about those things, I feel like my times when I go college me and high school, everybody would have been like, "Mush, that's bad. You're a bad person." And it's like, you know, there's a level of letting go of that. It feels, I take them seriously, and I feel like you need to take these things and give them the weight that they deserve. But I do feel like they're, you know, pretty much, or at least for me, I feel like they're sacred, you know, experiences in my life that, you know, I take seriously and I really spend a lot of time digesting the things that I learn.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
I like, and to another G word for your grok, as gestalt, I think I learned that the other day. It's a thing that cannot be divided into its subparts, or else it would lose the capacity of the thing. So vanilla, the gestalt of vanilla is best understood by experiencing it. It could only be understood by experiencing it, because if you take away just that experience, you no longer know what vanilla is.
Exactly.
Huh. And vanilla is my favorite flavor of ice cream. Also,
did a good vanilla. Oh, brilliant.
Everything else that's there is beautiful. And then Sonder, I think you might have mentioned this the other day, but I'd love to hear the last.
That is S-O-N-D-E-R, and it's a noun. So the dictionary definition is the profound feeling of realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own.
That blows my mind. Yes. I would drive. I remember as a kid, this is one of the, I don't have many thoughts or memories from when I was a kid, but I remember one, I would drive and sit in the car and just watch the house. I'm like, you have a job and you have a job and you have a job and you have, and every single house, I'm like, how do all of you have jobs? And what the complexity of life, you have all these memories and you have all these things, and you have a car and debt payments and things you like to do, and it all fits in, and it just blows my mind. I just don't get it.
And then with the way this was built on, when I saw it, it was like, in a state of sonder, one is in touch with the realization that every single one of us is simultaneously the main character, supporting actor, and extra with no lines in a series of infinitely and intricately overlapping stories. And I was like, that's freaking cool.
I love it. Greg, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much again. I just love talking to you. I have any idea where it's going to go, but it's always valuable and beneficial. You are a brilliant mind.
I always appreciate you having me. And I'm super pumped to see you in a couple of weeks.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. I got so many things to do. But we'll talk more about that offline. But otherwise, thank you so much. And until next time.
Thank you.